You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services announced it would put in place conscience protections for people who say that their moral or religious convictions prevent them from providing certain medical procedures. The medical procedures people are thinking about sometimes related to abortions, possibly gender identity services such as hormone replacement or gender reassignment surgery for transgender individuals. Coming up, we'll hear from an advocate for the LGBTQ community who says that these conscience protections could have a dramatic negative impact. You can call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Chelsea Duffy joins us now. She's legislative and PAC director for Wisconsin Right to Life, which supports the move. Chelsea, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And Chelsea, what was your reaction to the new guidelines from the Trump administration?
We found this to be a very encouraging development. I know I receive calls all the time at my office from medical professionals seeking to exercise their conscience protections, which are written into laws starting from 1973 to even today, laws that have been passed under different administrations, different Congresses, and they're looking to exercise their conscience rights and are experiencing difficulties because the healthcare providers that they are currently working under are either not aware of those laws or not abiding by them. So to have this support from the Health and Human Services Department will mean a lot for medical workers throughout the country.
On a practical level, what would change under these new guidelines?
So what would change is that the executive branch is now enforcing the law. We did not see this under the Obama administration. In fact, they ignored many conscience protection laws that have been passed since 1973. And so now this administration is taking seriously laws that have been passed, such as the Church Amendment or the Coates-Snow Amendment, and ensuring that they are enforced throughout the country so that medical professionals can pursue their careers without worrying about their consciences being violated.
And what kind of practices, procedures do you hear from providers when they call you up saying they're worried that their conscience protections aren't being respected?
Sometimes it's something as simple as, a pharmacist is uncomfortable with administering a drug that they know was developed using aborted fetal tissue. Sometimes it can be as dire as a physician is being pressured into participating or referring to an abortion. And we want to make sure that the rights of those physicians are protected because no one should be coerced into supporting or providing for an abortion.
With the pharmacist example, people might say if you become a pharmacist, you have an obligation to your patients to provide them with medications that they've been legally prescribed. What would you say to that objection?
I would say that that's taking issue with law that's been standing for many years, that we've seen conscience protection laws passed under Republican Congresses, Democratic Congresses, and unfortunately what we see when conscience right protections are not being pursued is that good medical professionals are bullied out of their field because they truly want to commit themselves to healing without hurting their patients, especially in the tragic circumstance of abortion, which takes a human life.
There have been concerns about contraceptive prescriptions, also a pharmacist not wanting to prescribe that, maybe being the only pharmacist in the house at a time or in the store at the time. Is that do they have the right to this kind of conscience protection if they object to the use of contraceptives?
Well, once again, this comes down to, are we going to allow space for medical professionals to pursue their profession without issues of conscience, or are we going to set up a field where people who truly want to pursue their field are bullied out of it because they have moral objections to certain practices? And I think the most dire cases of this have come down to abortion cases. We've seen people in other states, such as California, losing their jobs because they refuse to participate in abortion. And we find that to be a tragedy. And so we stand up for all conscience rights, knowing that at the worst, when they are violated, medical professionals either lose their jobs or are coerced into an awful act such as abortion.
Chelsea Duffy is with us from Wisconsin Right to Life, talking about guidelines from the Trump administration on the enforcement of conscience protections for medical care providers who decline to perform certain services over religious or moral grounds. One, in the guidelines from HHS, their Conscience and Freedom Rights webpage, one of the protections is for providers who were coerced into performing procedures that are against your religious or moral beliefs. And one concern that people have is that's really broad. It could go way beyond abortion or contraception or fetal tissue testing. It opens a lot of doors to any kind of objection. Is that a valid concern?
I think this is garnering needed attention on conscience rights, because what I've found, at least in my own personal experience, is that the recognition of conscience rights is often overlooked, and that's why so many medical professionals are calling offices like mine asking how they can protect their rights. So them opening the door on this issue, I think, is an encouraging step, because too often it's overlooked and people's rights are violated at the end of the day.
Let's bring on a caller. We've got Ben on the line in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Ben?
I really have a hard time understanding the rationale here. What's happening is a situation where people who get into a certain profession basically claim the right to decide for themselves whether or not they should follow the principles of that profession. I can imagine the situation of a law enforcement officer who decides that certain classes of criminals he has a moral objection to arresting, so he just won't do that. If these moral objections are so powerful for these individuals, it seems to me that they should be willing to sacrifice their profession and take up a profession that doesn't interfere with their moral obligations.
Ben, thanks for the call. Chelsea, what do you say to Ben?
Well, Ben, the fundamental part of pursuing medicine is healing the patient without harming them. For example, if you're asking a physician that they, you know, they must participate in assisting a suicide, that goes against the very fundamental proposition of medicine to heal the patient, and instead they're purposely harming them to the point that they're ending a human life. The same goes for an abortion. Coercing a physician into an abortion forces them to participate in an act that inherently does not heal. It harms the patient to the point of death. And so what we're doing, especially in the medical field, is bullying people out of a field that is so fundamentally oriented to healing and not hurting.
Thanks for the call, Ben. Chelsea, can you talk about the state of laws here in the state? Does Wisconsin have specific and separate protections as compared to the federal guidelines and rules?
Yes, we have passed conscience protection laws here in the state of Wisconsin as well. And we've seen waves of these come through over the years. You know, since 1973, since legalized abortion, pro-life advocates realized we need to protect the rights of physicians who wish to pursue their field without hurting any patients. And so we see that on the state level, on the federal level, and we're encouraged that the administration is enforcing these laws now and ensuring that conscience rights are protected.
And I asked for your reaction, but this was a big weekend for the pro-life movement with a big march and events around the country. Can you talk about the responses you've been hearing as part of that?
Well, we sent a bus to the March for Life this year, and the marchers who came back were just so encouraged with the state of the pro-life movement and what we can do in the future. We're seeing these encouraging signs from pro-life leaders that we can advance pro-life legislation, and we as a movement continue to grow and grow every year. There was a huge turnout for the March for Life. So many people my age, the millennials, turning out for this event. And so it's really encouraging to see our movement grow and continue to advocate for the right to life.
Chelsea, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Chelsea Duffy, Legislative and PAC Director for Wisconsin Right to Life. She joined us today to talk about the support for conscience protections, which allow medical care providers to abstain from certain procedures for religious or moral reasons. Updated guidelines from the Trump administration came out on that Friday. Now we continue our conversation about conscience protections from the other side of the issue. We just heard from Chelsea Duffy from Wisconsin Right to Life, who said it makes legal sense to allow people to abstain from providing care or services based on religious convictions. But our next guest says that conscience protections won't just have an effect on people seeking abortion-related services. It could also have a negative impact on communities throughout the country, especially LGBTQ individuals. Laree Cook Daniels is the Program and Policy Director at Forge. That's an advocacy group for transgender individuals and their families. It's based in Milwaukee. Laree, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And what was your reaction to the news of these new guidelines from the Trump administration?
Well, those of us that are doing policy advocacy for the rights of LGBT people are very concerned about the new regulations or the proposed regulations, in part because they are so vague in many places. It looks like it may be possible not only for healthcare providers to say that they don't want to participate, but it's not clear that that right is not being extended to people like the receptionist in the doctor's office who just says to you, I'm not going to let you see the doctor. Or in one case that we had, a physician had scheduled a procedure for a transgender patient, and a hospital administrator decided the hospital would not do that procedure, even though the patient and the doctor said it was necessary. So the problem with this regulation is that it could open the door to a lot of anti-LGBT movements. And it's really important to remember that while it's religious rights are very important, and I would never want to force someone to participate in an abortion if they thought it was murder, but healthcare providers do many other things, some of them life-saving. And this regulation may open the door for, say, an ER doctor to say, I'm not going to serve you when you are there dying. So there's a question about magnitude here of, are we going to protect life or are we going to put religious objections over the right to living?
One concern I've seen brought up is specific to gender reassignment surgery, a physician or other healthcare provider being able to opt out of that. Is that a concern that you have?
Well, physicians are already deciding what procedures they will do or not do. There are extremely few physicians that will do gender reassignment surgeries, and they're all well-trained, the ones that do it. So it's not a case where they would be forced to do something they'd never done before and didn't want to do. Now, I do think that if someone is looking, a nurse or an orderly is looking for a job, I would suggest they not apply to a place that does gender reassignment surgery, those few places, if they really objected to it.
But it sounds like your bigger concern is that a healthcare provider, or as you say, some administrator on their staff, might refuse to provide any kind of service to someone whose lifestyle they disapprove of. Is that a concern?
That is yes, that is exactly my concern. And we've had many incidences of this. Over the last few years, we had a Michigan pediatrician that turned away a family because she said, I can't treat this child because the child had two mothers. We had a hospital that refused to give HIV medications to a person with HIV when he admitted that he had sex with other men. So these are just, I don't like your lifestyle, so I am not going to give you life-saving care. And that is a really big concern. One of our concerns with this particular regulation is it's coming out of an office that's headed by Roger Severino, who used to work for the Heritage Foundation and has made many, many, many anti-LGBT statements over the years, like LGBT is not normal, it's not biology, and he's written these regulations in a way that will allow healthcare providers to say, I will not treat you because I don't like your lifestyle.
Laree Cook Daniels is with us from Forge, an advocacy group for transgender individuals and their families based in Milwaukee. We're looking at the Trump administration's new conscience protections. They're called for medical providers to be able to decline services, treatments based on religious and moral objections. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us in Green Bay. Katie, hi.
Hi, thank you. I thought had some really great points here since I had called in. I've been listening on the line. I wanted to touch on the fact that I'm a nurse. I have been a nurse for several years. And in nursing school, we had a large portion of our training on ethics. And we're really focused on not inserting your moral belief on your patient or having it have any adverse effects to your care for a patient. So, if you had a rapist that walked in to the ER and I was the nurse serving the patient, I can't think about the fact that he may have done something awful. He deserves the same care as the woman who, he has raped. So I wonder where ethics plays a part in this moral decision-making aspect.
Katie, thanks for the call. Laurie, your thoughts?
Well, that is an issue, is how do people that go into health professions and have ethical training and actually take oaths about what they will and won't do, how does that mesh up with regulations like these that say, well, your religious beliefs trump those. Your religious beliefs are more important than the healthcare professional beliefs. So that is an issue. I did want to talk about another thing that surprised me when these issues came up. I've worked on LGBT aging issues since the 70s, so I have seen a lot of discrimination against LGBT elders. And what I didn't recognize is that 85% of continuing care retirement centers are religiously affiliated. So if we start promoting the right of religiously affiliated healthcare providers and healthcare facilities to turn away LGBT people, we are going to have a lot of problem finding care for LGBT elders when they are most in need of it.
Katie, thanks for the call. Go next to Lee in Williams Bay. Lee, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm calling just to say that I was listening earlier when Chelsea was speaking, and I got to tell you, I think she was out of her mind. If you're in a profession of health or pharmacy, you fill that doctor's orders. The pharmacists do not decide what the physician does, and I really think if these people can't fill the doctor's orders, then they should go and sell shoes. Thank you so much for all you do. I love your show.
Lee, thanks for the call. Laurie, as you mentioned, you, Laurie, are interested in making sure that people can observe their religious rights as much as possible. Is it possible we might be losing some talented healthcare providers because they have to do something that sometimes violates their religious principles?
LGBT people make up about 3% of the population. If these healthcare providers are feeling like they have to leave their profession because of the 3% of patients that they have moral objections to, I it's hard for me to cry crocodile tears for that. People need their health care. It's not like this is, you're ordering a newspaper or you're ordering a pizza. These are health care situations that are sometimes really, really critical. The other point that I wanted to make today is that the fear that gets placed on LGBT people when these kinds of systemic discrimination things come up is that people fear going into any healthcare office or any government service or accessing any services. Forge is an anti-violence organization, and we see over and over and over again people saying, I don't want to talk to law enforcement because they can discriminate against me. I don't want them to know that it was my same-sex partner that hit me because then the government's going to know who I am. So how far these kinds of regulations reach is much farther than people think. It really affects how people live.
And Laurie, the new guidelines really specify things, it seems like, related to abortion, but there is a vague statement, including we're coerced into performing procedures that are against your religious or moral beliefs. So as this comes into practice, as challenges start being made, what are you watching for to see how this is going to affect, if it's going to affect, the LGBT community?
I will be watching for the incidents of people dying and the incidents of people saying, my doctor says that he doesn't have to treat me anymore. I'll be looking for those kinds of really major pieces of discrimination by people who are paid by federal tax money.
And have you heard from healthcare providers talking about how they will respond to this?
Well, I think we just heard one who cited her own ethical training. Certainly we're hearing from LGBT healthcare professionals about how worried they are, because they know what happens to people when they fear discrimination and when they've experienced discrimination.
We'll leave it there for now. Laurie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Laurie Cook-Daniels, Program and Policy Director at FORGE. That's an advocacy group for transgender individuals and their families. It's based in Milwaukee. We've been talking about conscience protections in new guidelines from the Trump administration that could allow medical providers, healthcare providers, to opt out of providing services because of religious objections. We also heard an argument in favor of those new changes, the new guidelines from the Trump administration, from a representative of Wisconsin, Right to Life. And there's still time to hear from you. You can share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. First, Congress passed a short-term funding bill yesterday to reopen the government after it partially shut down over the weekend. Lawmakers reached an impasse last week, which ultimately led to the partial shutdown. The measure passed last night and was signed by President Trump. So it's all over, but the blame and the ongoing debate over immigration and another funding deadline in just a couple of weeks. Susan Johnson joins us now. She's an associate professor of political science and the director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, there's a lot of media talk about the winners and losers when we come out of a shutdown like this. On a wider note, Susan, do you think that this erodes trust in Congress and government, maybe even more than it had already been eroded?
That's a really hard one, because what is approval rating for Congress right now? In the low teens? So I'm not sure that it could get much lower. And President Trump's approval rating is, hovering at about 40%. I think that for most people, it's business as usual, or I guess I would say a lack of business as usual. And I don't know that this markedly is going to make a difference.
How does this one compare to the last big shutdown back in 2013?
That one went quite a bit longer. And so that one extended to about 2 weeks. And so there would have been more impacts, I would say, on people's lives. And there would have been more attention to getting it resolved, because things that people expect to happen weren't happening in terms of the service of government. With this one, given the fact that it happened on a Friday into Saturday, so it was mostly just over the weekend, and it was so brief, people didn't necessarily, I don't think, even know, unless you were following it in the news.
On a fundamental level, we've got this system where we keep having to have these debt ceiling votes, these funding appropriations to keep the government running, and there's this apparent temptation, if you have enough pull, enough votes in Congress, to take an issue and kind of hold that overall funding hostage. So in 2013, it was Republicans trying to cut funding for the Affordable Care Act. This time it was Democrats trying to come up with a DACA solution for the so-called Dreamers, the people brought into the country illegally. As long as we have this system, are we going to keep seeing this temptation to do this kind of thing?
I don't see why we wouldn't. I mean, we used to do budgeting under what we called regular order. And I won't go into all the details, but it was a process. And now we're at the point where, since September, we've had four continuing resolution votes, and now we're at the point where we're coming up on another one in just a couple of weeks. And this is even out of the ordinary for what I would say over the past 10 years has been budgeting by continuing resolution.
and this whole hostage-taking thing as a tactic. Republicans wanted to cut funding for the Affordable Care Act. That didn't happen. Democrats wanted DACA changes as a condition here. That didn't happen. Ultimately, it doesn't seem to work very well.
Well, no, and Matt, you alluded at the beginning of the segment to the fact that winners and losers and placing the blame and things like that, and the Democrats are taking a lot of heat for what some are saying is giving in after just a couple of days and getting nothing more than a promise that the Senate will debate on immigration legislation.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about the brief shutdown and what happens next. A lot of lawmakers have weighed in on this. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin talking about the outcome yesterday.
This shutdown did not need to happen. However brief, it inflicted needless costs on the country. There are no winners here today. I want to make that clear. No winners except perhaps the millions of families who depend on the Children's Health Insurance Program. Soon, the longest reauthorization in the program's history will about to become law. But this is not a moment to pat ourselves on the back, not even close. We very much need to heed the lessons of what just happened here. We need to move forward in good faith, yes, on DACA and immigration, yes, on funding our military so that it gets the resources that our military so badly needs. Let's address these urgent challenges.
Susan, let's pick one of those challenges he just mentioned, DACA and immigration. And this is still going to be tough. The Senate, there appears to be maybe room for a bipartisan agreement there. A lot of House Republican conservatives say it's a non-starter for them. The president has given various signals over the last couple of weeks on what he'd sign. What do you make of, as of this minute, the state of the debate over DACA and immigration?
Well, I think that you laid it out pretty well. The Senate, like you said, there's a group of Republicans in the Senate who have been very active in advocating for immigration reform. Lindsey Graham, for example, has been doing this for quite a while in the Senate. And there seems to be an agreement that the Senate could pass a bill that would provide protection for those impacted by DACA and then make some other changes as well. So I think that there could be compromise there. When you move over to the House, you have, as Speaker Ryan indicated recently, the idea that he would be invoking what is called the Hastert rule, which means that you don't pass anything out of the House unless the majority of the majority is supportive of it. So that idea would be that any immigration changes that would come out of the House would have to have a majority of Republicans supporting it. And I think that that's really tough given the range of positions on immigration, and the House tends to be more conservative in the context of this issue, or there tends to be a more vocal group in the House that's more conservative on this issue. And as far as President Trump goes, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader himself, said that we have no idea what President Trump is looking at. And I heard him as recently as yesterday say we need to know what he's willing to support and go along with. So as far as what happens, I think we have a commitment in the Senate that there will be some debate and perhaps some votes, but that's about all we know right now.
When it comes to DACA and protections, again, for people brought into the country illegally as children, they had this protection from deportation under the Obama administration. The Trump administration says that's ending. It's tied up in the courts. It seems like a public opinion is in favor of continuing these protections. What are we hearing from Congress and the president? Do people want to provide protections for the DACA recipients?
You're right. When you look at polling data, it's really not even close. I mean, it's pretty a strong majority of the country supports the idea of providing some sort of protection. The president has pretty consistently spoken in support of this group of what we call the Dreamers and providing them some sort of protection. But at the same time, he's also in other forums or on Twitter not spoken in support of this policy. So it's really difficult. When you talk to members of Congress, all Democrats and a lot of Republicans, there's support there. But I think we have to consider, I guess, what is it that other people want in exchange for these protections, because that kind of gets down to the nuts and bolts of it. And when you're thinking about, let's say, some of the more conservative Republicans in the House of Representatives who are maybe not as supportive but could be swayed, they're going to want a whole lot more to go into a package. Border security, for example, significant changes to the way that we allow immigrants into this country regarding things like family members being able to sponsor other family members or the diversity lottery and things like that. And so I think it's a matter of not just support of DACA, but what concessions are Republicans, particularly in the House, going to demand in order to get something to protect DACA passed.
This has been a long story with immigration reform, arguments over whether Congress should take one issue at a time, you know, just DACA or just the status of people here illegally, or just security, or security then the other stuff, or one big bill. And we can't even, it seems like we can't even agree how to argue about this and put it in a forum to be debated in Congress.
Well, right, and this goes back to, you know, President George W. Bush tried to advance this idea of comprehensive immigration reform. So this isn't the first time that we've struggled with it. But I would say both sides are very suspicious, and I would say rightly so, that who wants to be the one to go first to say, we'll give you this on a promise that we'll talk about that later? I don't know in this environment that I would make that bet.
Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater. She's with us to talk about this weekend's partial government shutdown and what happens next. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the government shutdown? What do you think it means for our elected leaders? Should it be a wake-up call? If you are in support of Republicans, do you like how they handled it? If you're a Democrat, what do you think of the way Chuck Schumer and others handle it? There's been criticism from the left in the Democratic Party. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the government shutdown with Susan Johnson. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your opinions on the government shutdown this weekend, on the series of continuing resolutions, last-minute fixes on the federal budget, and how Congress and the president should tackle immigration issues, including the Dreamers, DACA? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Want to give a listen to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Democratic side of things. Here's what he said yesterday.
The majority, however, has forgotten the lessons of the Founding Fathers. They have shown that they do not know how to compromise. Not only do they not consult us, they can't even get on the same page with their president from their own party. The congressional leaders tell me to negotiate with President Trump. President Trump tells me to figure it out with the congressional leaders. This political catch-22, never seen before, has driven our government to dysfunction.
Susan, can you talk about what he said about Republicans there, differences, maybe confusion between congressional Republicans and the Republican president?
Well, I think that it's a challenge for congressional Republicans in the sense that they can't necessarily, if they were asked to state the president's position on immigration, I don't know that they'd be able to do it. And as I said earlier, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said as much. And we've heard President Trump talk quite nicely about the Dreamers, but we also know that President Trump made a major part of his campaign platform building the wall and making other changes to immigration policy. So as far as if you think about the president as being the leader of his party and therefore setting the agenda, it's really difficult because it becomes a moving target, not just day to day, but hour to hour and sometimes in 15-minute increments.
Let's go to our callers now. We have Paul with us in Wausau. Paul, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think, Paul?
Well, I was just mentioning how it seems like both sides kind of, nobody wants to give at all. It's almost like, hey, if you're not going to give us A, B, and C, we're not going to give you 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, nothing will get done if, you know, I mean, they want DACA, the other side wants a wall. Well, either somebody's going to have to compromise or we'll just be continuing the shutdowns and, what do they say, kicking the can down the road.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, has Congress gotten worse at compromise?
Oh, I would think absolutely. And I think that, you know, I've heard an interesting argument made by several people lately that we need to return earmarks to the budgeting process. And earmarks are where a member of Congress can be, you know, offered a lane widening or a new bridge or stuff, something in their district that would kind of get them to go along with a bill or a budget item. And I find that really interesting because they were eliminated because people thought that amounted to a bit of bribery. But now we're at the point where it's become so difficult to move things through the legislative process and make these sort of compromises that people are, you know, bringing up some of these ideas that we moved aside in the name of reform.
Paul, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Clint from St. Louis, but here in Wisconsin right now. Clint, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I'm enjoying the program.
Thanks.
And what I really think is you brought it up about many of these continuing resolutions that the Constitution requires we have a budget every year. That's not been done for 10 years. And how would you audit our country right now without a budget every year? So this is all smoke and mirrors. We're not getting to the problem. And therein lies it all. I mean, why not kick the can down the road? We don't hold anybody responsible. It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican.
Clint, thanks a lot for the call. Just do an actual budget, he says, Susan.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, and you know, like I said, when we teach this stuff, there is a process in place that requires a whole lot of stuff to go on in order to pass a yearly budget. And we used to do that. As a country, we used to pass the various appropriation bills as necessary. There used to be congressional hearings. There used to be, you know, feedback sought. And now we just bounce from continuing resolution to continuing resolution. And as the previous caller said, just keep kicking the can. And it's gotten kind of silly now where we're passing not even, you know, ones that go for months and months or even for the whole year, but now we're at 2 weeks at a time.
Clint, thanks for that call. We're talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about the shutdown and the aftermath. Back to your calls now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I was really disappointed that the Democrats bailed out on their strategy so early on. I feel like if they actually kept the government shut down for a week or maybe 2 weeks, they might actually had a chance to win a compromise and maybe win over some moderate Republicans that would actually want to vote for something on immigration. I'm just really disappointed that they caved so early. I think that they didn't do themselves any favors, and they just made themselves look really weak.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. Peter is not alone, Susan. A lot of liberal organizations criticizing Democrats in the Senate who voted for this, using phrases like cowardice, things like that. They want them to stick to the shutdown for longer on behalf of DACA. What do you think of maybe a rift between Democrats in the Senate and their some of their base anyway?
Yeah, I think with the idea, one of the problems was that they were losing moderate Republicans, not picking them up. So that was one problem. One of the best ways I heard this described was that Chuck Schumer made, and he's the minority leader for the Democrats in the Senate, that he went with the 2018 senators and not the 2020 senators. And what that means is that he made the decision that what was best likely for senators coming up for re-election. I mean, these are purely political decisions, and maybe people don't want to hear that, but they are. And so as a result, he went with that group who needed maybe to not have the government be shut down. And a lot of the senators who have come out and spoken against this are also eyeing a White House run in 2020. So it seems like what the Democrats were doing was looking at what's the potential short-term negative. And therefore made the decision that way. But, yeah, they're in big trouble with a lot of their liberal supporters.
Thanks for the call, Peter. We'll go now to Sue in Fish Creek. Sue, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I have two very different points. One is this can't be kicked down the road because we're talking about 800,000 human beings' lives versus an inanimate object, a wall. And it is very startling to me that our country would pit human life against an inanimate object in argument. And the other one is we're Foreign Service family. And I truly feel like it's the job of the government to make a budget. This has affected our lives overseas off and on. It's their job. One of their jobs is to get a budget. And when they don't have a budget, they should be docked pay. Their paycheck should stop, and they should be docked a certain amount of money for each day that they don't have a budget in place. And I bet they would come to consensus.
Sue, thanks for the call. And Susan, in addition to Sue's idea, I've seen some analysis suggest maybe this is, if you're weighing, do I go into government service or not, this risk of shutdown and disruption and not getting paid for a while is something on the side of the scale that says, no, stay out of that kind of job.
Right, yeah. I mean, I agree that that might be something that might keep you out of it.
Sue, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, everybody in the media, I think, is analyzing who wins, who loses, as I said at the outset in this. But in the long haul, say by November, voting time, do people remember what happened over the last few days?
Honestly, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think this was such a short time, and the news cycle has gotten to be so short lately that there will be so many things yet this month, let alone through November, that I think this becomes a distant memory by the time that happens.
And now the federal government is, as you said, funded for a couple weeks. February 8th, I think, now is the deadline. Are we having these conversations again in 2 weeks?
Maybe. I mean, I guess it depends what we see come out of the Senate. And I think to Sue's point about kicking the can, it is about people and more than just the can, you know, but it's still a very important thing.
Susan, thanks a lot, as always, for joining us today.
Absolutely.
We've been talking to Susan Johnson. She's an associate professor of political science and director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research at UW-Whitewater. She joined us to talk about the government shutdown this weekend, the short-term budget measure approved yesterday to keep the government going for another 2 weeks or so, and whether this impacts the public's trust in government. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this ongoing issue. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.